Chapter 17. Becca Eckersley, George Washington University, March 14, 2011, 11 months before her death. The semester crawled by, with long days spent figuring out their schedules and the best way to avoid each other. Awkward encounters, however, were impossible to avoid. The last time they talked was on the deck of the Stilt House, and after a month of failure, Becca and Jack stopped trying to get through to Brad. Nothing could be said to change his opinion of them, so Becca and Jack avoided him as much as they could. When forced to go home, Jack did so late at night. Brad's bedroom door was usually closed, and on the rare occasion Jack entered the apartment to find Brad in the living room, a common scene followed of Brad standing from the couch, clicking off the television, and closing his bedroom door behind him. Becca talked to Jack about moving out, but he was tied to the apartment for the rest of the semester, and his free ride included just about everything but room and board. What his parents sent each month was barely half his rent, and he covered the rest with his job on campus. He turned down Becca's offer to help him with her own money. He would hunker down for 2 more months and finish his senior year in the apartment. It wasn't hard to find an alternate place to stay. Gail was genuinely happy for them and didn't care that Jack spent almost every night in Becca's room. In March, Becca received her acceptance letter to George Washington Law, and she and Jack celebrated with a nice dinner. 2 weeks later, Gail got into the law program at Stanford, and she and Becca celebrated with beers at Bucky's, then cried when they realized they would be so far away from each other. Jack's letter from Harvard came a day later, and the three of them toasted in Becca's apartment, where they laid the three acceptance letters next to each other and raised their glasses to what lay ahead. Jack had his doubts during these celebrations. He camouflaged them with fake smiles and imitation bravado. He knew as spring dawned on the East Coast, so too did something Jack thought might wake someday. He was surprised it took so long. He expected it when they returned from Christmas break, and not even the dissolution of the strongest friendship he had ever been part of could entirely distract his internal radar from what was coming. No one knew how it leaked, or who leaked it, or in what fashion it trickled down to those who shouldn't have discovered it. But Jack didn't need an article in the paper or a campus blogger detailing the events that brought on Milford Morton's suspicion. What was meant for the four of them had spread to at least a few people who Brad hoped to impress, and those few slipped it to a few more, and a few more after that, until eventually 74 of the 122 seniors who sat for the final in Milford Morton's business law course had a copy of the stolen exam. Once out of the bag, the proverbial cat ran wild around campus. The investigation and the details it uncovered spread like spilled ink on a thirsty cloth, so thick and dark that only some serious work, and probably penalties, could erase the sort of graffiti a scandal like this would leave on the walls of the university. Someone needed to take the fall, shoulder the blame, and jeopardize their future. As an example for other kids who made such poor decisions, but mostly to show the world of academia that GWU was an outstanding university that did not tolerate such betrayal of standards. The faculty knew the right questions to ask and the proper buttons to push to make students talk, especially those with law degrees and political futures on the line, not to mention prominent parents hoping to avoid public embarrassment. Jack understood now why it took until March for this to break. As law school acceptance letters trickled in, they would be used to make the right kids talk. By the time tulips readied to bud and the grass began the nourishing process that would bring it back to green, a poisonous trail very opposite to spring's transformation ran its way to Brad and Jack's doorstep. The president of the university called and asked to see each of them at 3 o'clock that afternoon. They had not spoken since Christmas, but their current predicament got them both quickly over the awkwardness.
"My father will kill me when this comes out," Brad said.
He and Jack sat on the hood of Jack's beaten Volvo, which was parked at the bank of the Potomac. They watched a big tugboat hauling sand from Maine crawl past. It was still too cold for recreational boats, and the water was mostly an empty canvas glistening with the mid-morning sun of early March. Brad put his face in his palms.
"We just screwed up our lives."
Jack heard the despair in his friend's voice,
saw it in his eyes when Brad finally looked up, with welled tears hanging on his eyelids.
"Here's the deal," Jack said, staring straight ahead at the Potomac and the tugboat that moved over its surface. "I broke into Morton's office by myself. I took the exam alone and distributed it. Over 70 other kids saw the exam. You're just one of them, nothing more. They're not going to kick 70 seniors out of school. They want one person to pin this on."
Brad slowly raised his hands.
"What are you talking about?" "I'm taking the fall for this." "No, that's not happening."
Jack laughed.
"It's gotta happen. It's either me or you. Trust me on this, Brad. The kids they talked to have pinned this on us with nail guns. The dean sat them down, laid out their acceptance letters or their financial firm offers, and then made an offer himself. What do you think they did? Stayed quiet? Please. They threw us under the bus to save their own asses. There's no reason for both of us to go down."
The tug let out a long, low whistle, and a mile downriver, a drawbridge began to separate.
"Listen," Jack said. "This has nothing to do with Becca, or what happened over break, okay? The truth is, I've got nothing going on. I'm a poor kid from Wisconsin who really doesn't give a shit if Harvard retracts its offer. That was for my resume, not because of any great love I have to be an attorney. There are dozens of other schools that would gladly take a Harvard reject, and I've got no psychotic father to answer to. I want to write speeches someday, and a blemish on my transcript isn't going to prevent that. Running for senator, maybe, but not writing for one." "Jack, I came to you with the key. I solicited you to come with me to get the test.
And I'm a big boy. I said yes. I wanted the adrenaline rush of breaking in. And I'm taking the fall, Brad."
"You didn't even use the test. I mean, that's what Becca said. You didn't even use it, and you want to take the heat for stealing it?"
"It wasn't about the test, Brad. It was about the adventure. And I stole the damn thing just as much as you did."
"I don't know, Jack."
But Jack did know. His friend would take the offer. Brad knew, too. The rest was just a game. A way of accepting through the back door. Not really wanting such a thing, but only taking it because it was offered so sternly.
"I don't know what to say," Brad said. "Say yes when Penn asks you into their law program. Or Harvard. But I know Penn is your first choice."
Jack jumped off the hood of his car.
"And say yes again when old Jackie boy comes begging for a job in a few years."
Jack pulled open the driver's side door.
"Come on. Let's get our story straight before we see the dean."
As they climbed in the car, Jack grabbed the steering wheel and looked over at Brad.
"You know, they say the crime is not what brings people down."
Brad smiled.
"Yeah, it's the cover-up."
"What's that?" Jack asked, pointing at a torn envelope on the kitchen table and a letter next to it. They were in Becca's apartment.
"Cornell," Becca said.
"Yes? No?"
Becca nodded.
"What the hell?"
Jack said in an excited voice.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
She shrugged. "I don't know. I'm too worried. It came a couple days ago, but we have all this pressure on us with the Morton thing, and I haven't felt like celebrating. And now you're about to see the dean to confess to something that wasn't your idea. It's not a good idea, Jack."
"First, it's already been decided. Second, holy shit, you got into an Ivy League school."
She took a deep breath. "Still think I'm staying at GW. I'm here, I'm familiar with the area, I'm comfortable. And to be honest, if I'm serious about joining my father's firm, there's no difference between GW Law and Cornell. Maybe some snooty client will only want an Ivy League grad working for them, but unlikely."
"Really? Well, it's good to have options."
"Plus, who knows, Jack? We don't know what's about to happen with all this. I cheated on a final exam, and if that gets out, I guess I don't have to say it. Which is why I don't think you should do this, Jack. Yes, you stole it, but you didn't even use it. Why are you taking all the blame?"
There's no other way for it to work, Becca. Brad's not taking the blame by himself, okay? That's just not how he operates. And if neither of us owns up to this, you know what happens? The blame starts to spread. Guess where the first stop will be after Brad and me? Becca looked away. Guess.
Me, Becca said.
Correct. You and then Gail. Want to know why? Because every kid who cheated knows Brad and I stole the test. Brad couldn't keep his mouth shut. And they know you and Gail had the first look. And if the university puts pressure on those kids, they'll tell the dean and the president and anyone else who asks exactly what they know. So it's either me or all of us.
Why not Brad?
Jack laughed. Come on, Becca. That's not going to happen.
Jack stood up.
Supposed to talk to the dean at 3, so I've got to go.
Congrats on Cornell.
Becca stood up and wrapped her arms around his waist, placing her head on his shoulder.
Good luck.
He kissed her forehead.
Tell me when good things happen to you from now on, okay?
Becca nodded her head as she silently cried on his chest. Chapter 18. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 11th, 2012. Day 7. During the past week in Summit Lake, intrigued by the story she was chasing and captivated by the girl who was killed, Kelsey found an oasis from her own trouble. But back now, since walking through the Eckersleys' home, was a repeating loop of vague memories and foggy images of the morning she was attacked, of the man she could not place, a masked face she could not identify. Kelsey spent many hours over the last month pulling those memories into sharper focus, arranging them in chronological order, and working to piece together the events of that day. It was as if her mind wore an electric collar, though. It could only go so far without hurting itself. Kelsey could get to a particular point in her memory and then go no further. Part of it, she knew, was that she didn't want to go further. Didn't want to see the details of that morning or to relive the horror. Some part of her believed she could bury those memories and let them decompose. Another part knew it couldn't be so easy. Placed on the other side of the crime, victim instead of investigator, she hated the process and the procedure and the fact-gathering. She despised the detective's questions and connotations about what she wore that morning and whom she was seeing outside of work and how she conducted herself at the office. Never coming straight out and announcing their suspicions, Kelsey knew damn well the detectives were asking if she was a promiscuous woman who flirted with colleagues and wore inappropriate clothing. They didn't have the courage to ask her if she might have brought the whole situation on herself, but after a couple days of questioning, Kelsey knew what they were suggesting. She was relieved when they left her alone and went out to futilely look for the man with no face and no name and no chance of being caught. Then, Kelsey turned off her phone and locked her front door and didn't leave for a month. In the weeks off from work and while disconnected from the world, Kelsey succumbed one afternoon to researching what she'd been through. Pouring through reference material and making sense out of volumes of information was how she figured things out in her career, and so she tried the same thing in her personal life. She bought a bag of self-help books from the bookstore that dealt with the healing process women go through after assault. She read them all in a 3-day span made of little sleep, loads of coffee, and leftover Chinese. After her reading binge, she took comfort, knowing that all the emotions swirling through her mind and her body were not unique. Others shared her pain. The books suggested she would feel loneliness and isolation, and she did. Some of it was because Penn Courtney had not allowed her into the office for a month, but it was also from refusing to walk out her door for fear of what waited. Anger and resentment toward men, too, she read, would be part of the process. And though there was no bitterness in her heart or mind, Peter Ambrose was the first man she'd been around, and her bizarre dream the other night of Peter running down the dock in front of the Eckersleys' house made Kelsey question herself about trusting a man. She allowed herself this emotion. Nighttime would be especially difficult, the books told her. Her nightmares proved this. But she took pride in the fact that when she wasn't sleeping, the dark hours of night were her favorite time. It was when she watched old movies and finished the novels she was reading. It was a time when she knew the rest of the world was asleep, and only then was she comfortable relaxing, knowing she wasn't missing anything. She would be scared, the books told her. And it might take months, or longer, to walk down the sidewalk, or to her car, or to jog the streets. Sometimes, these things would never again be possible. And this much was true. She was scared. There was no denying this. But running was her thing, her passion. A private time when she reviewed cases and articles in her mind. When she was stuck on an article, the isolation of running allowed Kelsey to sort her thoughts. And if she ever felt overwhelmed or too close to a story, the miles were spent simply getting away from all those thoughts that ran through her head. Erase it all for an hour or two and come back refreshed. In the weeks just after the rape, though, the thought of running anywhere, let alone through the woods where the attack happened, was too much. But here in Summit Lake, Kelsey made a decision. She refused to allow her fear to take away what she loved so much. She forced herself to walk the town and jog through the canopied forest to the waterfall. The horror of that morning still coursed through her, but each mile took her a little farther from it. Most of all, the books told her, she would feel a sense of loss. Almost, although not quite, the experts wrote, like someone had died. And this was essential to the rebirth she would need to experience to fully heal. Perhaps this was the sensation that overwhelmed her in the Stilt House the other morning. What she took from the self-help books was that everyone heals in their own way and at their own pace. Some reflect more than others on the things they encounter in life and weigh those happenings differently. Kelsey finally decided she would pick which events shaped her life and defined her personality. This single, awful day would not be one of them. Simple as that. She wasn't able to throw the books away, so she tossed them into the return bin at the local library and headed back to work the next day. A week later, she was in Summit Lake, on the trail of young Becca Eckersley, who had gone through the same thing as Kelsey, but who was not so fortunate to wake up in a hospital bed the next day. Always a believer in fate, and a student of the persistent voice in her head that guided her and helped her find her way, Kelsey knew she was in Summit Lake for a reason greater than herself, for something more than the 3-piece article she was sent to write. Night fell, and by 8 p.m. the sky was alive with stars. Kelsey pulled the collar of her jacket against the lake breeze. She stood in front of the Winchester Hotel and watched a black SUV roll up. The passenger side window came down, and Peter Ambrose was behind the wheel. She walked over and rested her elbows on the window frame. "You sure about this?" she asked.
"It's your story, so it's up to you. But I'm a willing participant."
"Will you get in trouble?"
"If we get caught, we'll both get in trouble."
Kelsey looked down Maple Street at nothing in particular, then pulled open the door and climbed in. They were on a winding mountain road out of Summit Lake a few minutes later. "So tell me again where you got this information," Kelsey said as they drove.
"I put in a call to a pathologist friend of mine who works for the county. He knows about the Eckersley case. No specifics, only that it's all very hush-hush. He and other pathologists and technicians were told to stay out of the way of this investigation while the state authorities take over. Only the Buchanan County Medical Examiner has any privileges."
"That's who wrote the partial autopsy report you got from me a few days ago?"
"Correct. My friend tells me there's something else going on with this case. Rumors are wild, and speculation is high."
"What are the rumors?"
"Something's being covered up. The ME is ready to resign over the secrecy, and it's causing major trouble down at the county building. It's got everyone talking. And so when I put a call into my buddy, he was very happy to know someone was looking into this story."
"And how is he going to help us?"
"He's not. Just in case anyone asks you. But I ended up with an access card to the county building and a password for the Eckersley file. I'm hoping if we have a look, we'll find the full autopsy report.
See what the fuss is about.
They took the winding roads out of the mountains for half an hour until they entered the town of Eastgate, where the Buchanan County Government Center was located. It was close to 9 p.m. when they pulled into the parking lot of a pizza joint. They found a booth by the window and ordered beers and a pepperoni pizza. Kelsey took a sip of her draft.
Why are you doing this for me?
You could get in a lot of trouble.
You've got me interested in this case. If something's being covered up, I want to help you find it.
Plus, Peter said, as he took a sip of beer,
if you can't tell, I like you. You seem like a good person with the right intentions.
Thanks. I just hope this doesn't cause you any problems.
Peter smiled.
We're not stealing classified government documents. We're looking at an autopsy report that should be public record anyways. Tell me what you found since we talked last.
Where do I start? How about that Becca got married just before she was killed?
To whom?
I'm working on that.
You don't know?
Not yet.
Aren't there records?
Not that I can find. It doesn't make sense. But I'm sure about my source, so I have to figure that one out. The waitress came over with a deep dish pizza and placed a slice in front of each of them. My working theory is that Becca eloped and was killed before a marriage certificate was filed, therefore leaving no record.
No record, but a suspect.
Exactly. If I can figure out who she married. Kelsey took a bite of pizza. Also, Becca kept a journal, one she wrote in, or at least read from, the day she was killed.
Like a diary?
Yeah.
Doesn't it mention the name of the guy she married?
Probably does, but no one seems to know where it is. Kelsey put her pizza down. Becca had her journal 2 hours before she was killed, when she was studying at the coffee house in town. But there's no record of a journal listed on the evidence report, and when I had the opportunity to poke around the Eckersley's house, I saw no sign of it.
So where is it?
Kelsey shrugged. Someone has it. Either the state authorities found it and kept it off the evidence list, or...
Or what?
Or whoever killed her took the journal because he knew how damning it would be.
If the police found this journal, why would they hide it?
Don't know. Maybe for the same reason we're about to snoop around the county building looking for an autopsy report they won't publish.
What's your boss say about all this?
He's interested, just not excited about my approach.
I thought you said this is exactly what your magazine publishes. Shouldn't he be salivating over a homicide with potential cover-ups?
Oh, he is, trust me. He's just mad about the timing. He sent me here to get me out of the way for a while. Tie me up with a fluff piece for a couple of weeks. At least, I thought he did. He's mixed on the fact that I've actually stumbled onto something.
Yeah,
Peter said.
Why does your editor want his star reporter out of the way?
Kelsey took a sip of beer and unknowingly crossed her arms, shaking her head.
That's a story for another time.
I'd like to hear it sometime. Because I did some investigating on my own and understand you're a pretty big deal. You've got a best-selling true crime book, and you've got quite a following for your event pieces. So why would your boss waste your talents on a fluff piece?
It's a long story. Let's just say he wanted me out of the office for a while.
You get along with him?
Yeah, Kelsey said. I love him. Peter took a bite of pizza and raised an eyebrow. Not like that, Kelsey said. He's 70 years old. I love him like a father. Hate him the same way sometimes. Kelsey was still sitting with her arms crossed. Peter pointed at her half-eaten pizza slice.
You don't like it?
Too nervous. Peter looked out the window at the government center across the street. The building was mostly dark besides a few stray lights on the third floor. He dropped his pizza on the plate and wiped his mouth.
Ready then?
Kelsey nodded. As ready as I'll be tonight.
Let's go.
Peter paid the bill and together they walked across the street, leaving the car in the restaurant parking lot. The government center campus was lighted by a yellow halogen as they walked along the sidewalk to the front of the building. He pulled the card key from his pocket and inserted it into the slot. The red light changed to green, and Peter swung the door open. Kelsey took a deep breath and followed him inside. They walked past the elevators and entered the stairwell.
The three flights caused Kelsey's pulse to elevate more than it already was. Peter pulled the stairwell door open, the handle making a loud clinking noise. Everything, from their footsteps to the door handle, was intensified when set against the stillness of the empty building.
Okay, Peter said. He told me 3C.
They walked down the hallway. A glass wall stood to their left, through which they could see the dark workspace of a government office, a large reception area with chairs behind a chest-high counter. Beyond that, cubicles with a few computer monitors still glowing. When they came to Suite 3C, Peter again inserted the access card and listened for the lock to disengage. Kelsey looked down the hallway one last time before entering. 3C was a private office with a single desk and computer. Peter sat behind it, and Kelsey crouched down next to him. He touched the mouse and the computer came to life. He entered the password his friend had supplied to access the system, then entered Eckersley, Becca. A low tone sounded and then a message. Invalid entry. Peter looked at Kelsey. Here, Kelsey said. Try this. She pulled the keyboard toward her and typed Eckersley, Rebecca, Alice. A higher, more pleasant ring sounded. Then a box appeared, asking for a password. Peter typed it from memory, and a second later, Becca's full autopsy and toxicology report blinked onto the screen. Don't print it, Kelsey said. That will definitely leave a footprint. Probably entering the file has lit up a red light somewhere. You read, I'll take notes. Go. Kelsey pulled out her notepad. Peter read from the screen.
Official cause of death, suffocation. The trachea and larynx were collapsed by trauma, and this prevented oxygen from getting to the lungs. Said trauma determined to be caused by manual pressure to the neck, most likely from someone's hands. No lacerations to the neck, or other indications of tightening objects such as belts, ropes, or ligature.
Peter waited a second while Kelsey scribbled. Go. Peter read through some incidentals they had previously covered in the partial autopsy report while Kelsey took shorthand.
Okay, Peter said. It speaks here more extensively about the vaginal damage that confirms rape.
Peter scrolled down the screen.
Here, page 4. We haven't seen this. Evidence sequestered from the body and turned over to police. Semen, hair, head, facial, and pubic, fibers, wool, coat or gloves, skin shaving from 7 fingernails.
Peter scrolled further.
DNA sequestered from all samples match each other, indicating one attacker. See toxicology. Hold on.
Peter clicked on another screen and the toxicology report popped up.
Okay. It looks like they took DNA samples from Becca's father and brother and 3 cousins. No match on them.
He mumbled a minute as he read quickly and flipped between screens.
Okay. It looks like a construction crew who had worked in the house was also sampled. 5 men, no matches.
So, no DNA matches at all?
Not on the toxo report.
No other DNA taken? Like a husband?
Not listed on this report, no.
From down the hallway, the elevator chimed, and they both froze. They left the door to Suite 3C cracked, and Kelsey grabbed Peter's arm when she heard the elevator doors slide open. Quickly, Peter stood and went to the office door. He twisted the handle and silently pulled the door fully closed. He stood still and placed his ear to the wood. Kelsey was next to him with her ear, too, against the door. Their faces were inches apart and their breathing heavy. They tried to control their lungs and listen. They finally heard a muffled conversation and then whistling, which, after a minute, faded away. Peter placed his finger across his lips.
Shh.
He grabbed the handle and pushed the door open, sticking his head into the hallway. Kelsey did the same just below him. They saw a janitorial cart down the hall, with mop handles sticking up and rags hanging from the side. They both retreated into the room.
Hurry, Kelsey said.
Peter rushed back to the computer and scrolled through the rest of the autopsy.
There's more internal findings. Greater detail about the subdural hematoma.
He spit out some facts about brain swelling and blood patterns. Stomach contents that helped narrow the time of the attack. Semen location in the upper vaginal canal indicated Becca never stood up after the attack. He clicked screens back to the toxicology report. He quickly read through some final notes, then stopped.
Huh.
What? Kelsey asked, looking up from her notepad.
Here's the toxicology report and blood work they did on Becca.
What is it? Don't tell me she was doped up.
No, not a trace of drugs in her system. Just human chorionic gonadotropin.
What's that?
HCG.
Kelsey blinked her eyes. The pregnancy hormone? Chapter 19. Becca Eckersley, George Washington University, April 7th, 2011, 10 months before her death. Everyone in Milford Morton's class was required to retake the exam. The decision brought protests from the innocent students, and a few belligerent ones were allowed to skate quietly away. The faculty knew the ones who argued most and whose parents became involved were probably innocent, while the ones who protested least and kept their parents in the dark were guilty as sin. For Jack, he was given a failing grade and not allowed to retake the exam. This, too, was a strategic decision by the faculty, since close scrutiny of his transcripts revealed Jack had taken more hours than required during his freshman and sophomore years, and a failing grade in Milford Morton's business law class would still leave him with the necessary requirements for graduation. The failing grade would dirty his transcripts and slash his grade point average, however, which might affect his life after graduation. Most importantly, it would demonstrate a visible punishment while allowing the university to graduate the status quo of low-income students and avoid unwanted attention from groups who would pounce and attack in a very public way if a poor kid from Wisconsin had been booted from the university months before graduation, when everyone knew most of the students cheated on the exam. Jack wasn't sure exactly what the ordeal would do to his acceptance letter from Harvard, and for the first day or two after his verdict came, he decided not to look into the matter. He came home from the library in the early evening, 3 weeks since his meeting with the dean, to find Brad at the kitchen table, a torn envelope in front of him, along with a letter, folded in thirds. Jack slowed as he entered the apartment. He knew from the look on Brad's face what it all meant, but had to ask.
Well?
Brad faked a smile.
Rejected,
Brad said, in a strange voice meant to hide his sorrow, but which did just the opposite.
Just like everything else in my life,
he mumbled to himself.
Shit. Pen?
Brad nodded.
Screw Pen, Jack said. You've got others out there.
Brad stood up with pursed lips.
No, Jackie boy, that's the last of them. All the Ivy's passed.
His eyes widened in feigned excitement.
Oh, but I got into U of M. Can't wait for the that-a-boy from my old man on that one. He'll be real proud of his state-educated boy. I'll be a real hit at all his friggin' who's who parties with all his friggin' judge friends.
Jack's voice was quiet.
Everyone passed. It's a proud day in the Reynolds family.
Why didn't you tell me?
You've been a little out of touch, Jack. You and Becca.
Jack didn't touch that comment, or mention that swallowing the bullet for their little adventure had most likely cost Jack his own ride to Harvard. Instead, he said,
So take a year off. Find an internship.
Jack's words hung in the air, untouched and unnoticed.
I thought U of M had a good program. That's why you applied. It was my backup, and I only applied because my counselor forced me into it.
Brad slid his arm to the loop of his backpack. Then he looked at Jack.
It's actually a shitty school. It would give my father a goddamned heart attack if I attended.
Jack watched him walk slowly out the door, not closing it as he left. He heard Brad's footsteps mechanically descend the stairs. Jack took out his phone and dialed Becca's number.
Hey, major issues over here.
What's wrong? Becca asked.
Apparently, Brad got rejected from every law school he applied to, except Maryland. Never told anyone, unless you or Gail know.
He hasn't talked to me in 2 months, and I'm sure Gail doesn't know anything about it. There was a pause. Everywhere?
all the Ivies.
And we were all just out celebrating our acceptances.
He didn't seem too concerned that my acceptance will probably be rescinded. But either way, somebody's got to talk to him. He's a mess.
I'm coming over.
He took off.
Where?
No idea. Just threw on his backpack and left.
I'll call his cell, Becca said. And if he won't talk to me, I'll get Gail to call him.
Let me know.
Gail and Becca sat on one side of the booth, Jack on the other. Burgers and sodas covered the table. It was a strategy meeting on how to help their friend, who they were sure felt like the world was falling on top of him. I say we just go to your place and wait for him, Gail said. He has to come home eventually. Midnight, 2 a.m, doesn't matter. We'll all just stay up and wait for him.
He won't like the ambush, Jack said. Has he been talking to you lately? Jack asked Gail.
Yeah.
Doesn't screen your calls like he does to Becca and me?
Gail smiled. He's not pissed at me. And until today, every time I've called him, he's answered. He's been a little distant lately, and I guess I figured it had to do with, you know, you guys. But now I know it's because he's been shouldering this burden without telling anyone. Gail stirred her Coke. I thought he had a contact at Penn, through his father or someone.
I remember him saying something like that, Jack said. Guess it didn't come through.
Try him again, Becca said.
I've texted him 3 times in the last hour. He knows I'm looking for him.
Okay, Becca said. So we wait at the apartment. Then what? Then we get all this shit out on the table, Gail said. This is so stupid. We were all best friends a few months ago. Now no one talks to each other. That's not all our fault, Becca said.
No, Jack agreed. But some of it is. And Gail's right. We've got to get this stuff out there and talk about it. Then we've got to support Brad, who feels like his life just ended. And most of that comes from his friggin' father, who puts more pressure on the kid than anyone. And it's so crazy that Brad hates the man 1 second and then can't stand the thought of disappointing him the next.
Jack shook his head.
Whatever. Let's go wait for him.
They paid the bill and left the restaurant. It was a cool April night as they walked back to Jack's apartment, with winds blowing off the Potomac and carrying the scent of salmon and crabs. Jack's phone vibrated in his pocket from an incoming text message. They were at the base of the stairs to his apartment complex. The girls started up the stairs as Jack fished the phone from his pocket. The text was from Brad.
You took her from me, Jack. But I guess she was never really mine.
Is it Brad? Becca asked from the top of the stairs. Jack hesitated for a second, then shook his head.
No. Mass text from a professor about a paper due next week.
The girl stood at the top of the stairs as Jack read the message again. After a minute, the girls were restless. Hey, Jackie boy, Gail said from the landing in front of his apartment. Let's go. It's chilly out here. Jack looked at the text one last time, studying it before sticking his phone in his pocket. He wanted to shoot a text back to his friend, something to acknowledge Brad's pain or his own presumed betrayal. He slowly climbed the stairs, thinking of how to respond. He stuck the key into the lock and pushed open the door. As he did, a fragmented series of images came to him, played in his head like a movie clip, black and white, with static particles. The look in Brad's eyes earlier in the day as he left the apartment. Brad's rejection letter sitting on the table. His words.
Rejected. Just like everything else in my life.
Before the door was fully open, Jack knew what waited on the other side. A message back to his friend would not be possible. Becca screamed. Jack stood like a statue in the doorway. He never looked at Brad's face. Or if he had, his brain blocked the blood-red, bloated image from his memory. But stained forever in Jack's mind was his friend's feet, limp and slowly twirling 12 inches off the ground, an overturned chair lying still on the floor. Part 3. Hello, Detective. Chapter 20. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 12, 2012. Day 8. A cottony framework of snow-white clouds ripped and pulled their way across the sky, stretching over the lake and toward the horizon like a ceiling to the world. In the distance, an opening formed, as though solvent spilled from heaven had burned a hole in the clouds, and through it shined vibrant yellow rays of morning sunlight that landed on the waterfall and ricocheted off the granite. The water glowed orange as it fell. Kelsey stared at the mysterious scene. The morning falls. She woke early, with Becca's pregnancy causing her imagination to run wild with possibilities. So many questions formed in her head that sleep was again elusive. Now she stood at the bottom of the falls, with a good burn in her legs, and all the questions about Becca Eckersley organized in her mind. Her gaze traveled to the origin of the falls, where two boulders stood on top of the cliff and flanked the water as it passed between them. The force of the water had probably eroded the rock face over time, Kelsey figured, until eventually the stream swelled and a small trickle sweated between the stones. Years later, the relentless pressure forced a gap in the rocks until finally the weakest portion fell away and allowed the stream to pour from the edge of the cliff. Over time, the endless flow rubbed smooth the rocks to create a shuttle through which the water passed freely before falling down the mountain. The evolution of such a magnificent setting was amazing. Kelsey stared at the falls and knew no matter how complex, all mysteries could be traced back to their genesis. She was getting closer to the mystery here in Summit Lake. But stepping back the unknowns to reveal the truth about Becca Eckersley's death required Kelsey to span large gaps she couldn't fill on her own. Becca's parents were working to keep details of the case quiet, and now Kelsey confirmed that Becca, too, was keeping secrets. That she was married was one of them. That she was pregnant was another. And certainly enough to explain why Becca wanted her parents in the dark about her marriage. After a few minutes, the orange glow ended. The water foamed and frothed in the area under the falls, then sat quiet and still a short distance away as the lagoon reflected the cotton ball clouds. Mist coated the moss that clung to the side of the mountain.
I see you've become a fan.
Kelsey turned and saw Ray standing behind her. Her face was red from her jog through the canopied forest. Kelsey smiled.
Really beautiful here.
Almost before she could finish her sentence, Ray hugged her. Kelsey stood still for a few seconds and then slowly wrapped her arms around Ray.
You okay?
Ray held her for a long time before she squeezed one last time and let go.
I'm fine, Ray said, but I should have given you that the other morning. It's what friends do when they tell each other personal, private stuff that's hard to talk about. They hug each other and support each other. And I wish I'd done it the other morning, but you caught me off guard when you told me about what happened to you.
Kelsey swallowed hard, surprised to be so moved by the gesture. Perhaps it was because Ray was the first person, besides a brief and uncomfortable conversation with Penn Courtney, to acknowledge her situation and comfort her.
Thank you, Kelsey said. Her eyes were watery, and she blinked to contain the tears. You're a good person, Ray, and a good friend. I'm really glad I met you.
Ray smiled. Feelings mutual. Come on, let's dunk our feet. Kelsey followed Ray to the lagoon, and they both sat at the water's edge, on top of large boulders embedded in the ground around the lagoon. They unlaced their running shoes and plunged their feet into the water.
Why is the water so warm? Kelsey asked.
Natural springs. It bubbles up from deep underground where it's warmed. Without the waterfall, the lagoon would be too hot. The water from up top is ice cold, mixes with the hot stuff, and this is the result. People swim here year-round, even when it's snowing and the surface is steaming. Ray leaned back to look up at the falls, stared for several seconds before she continued. I walk down here sometimes, after the morning rush, kind of catch my breath and clear my head. Over time, I've learned this is a great place to sort out my feelings. If I could look down on myself sometimes, I think my face might look like yours does now.
How do I look? Kelsey asked.
Preoccupied, Ray said. Those big brown eyes of yours have a lot going on inside of them. I'm still convinced you're having boy issues.
Kelsey shook her head. Sorry to disappoint. And once you hit a certain age, we stop calling them boys.
What should I say? Adult male issues?
Kelsey smiled. I don't know. Guy issues?
Fine, Ray said. Your face looks like you're having guy issues. Dish.
Dish what? Kelsey said with a laugh. There's nothing to dish.
This doctor. Have you seen him lately?
Yes, Kelsey said. Last night, in fact.
I knew it!
Knew what? Kelsey continued to laugh. He's helping me with the Eckersley article. He's got sources in town.
Ray stared at her with raised eyebrows and a suppressed smile.
What's that look for?
I can tell you think I'm just some 20-year-old kid who calls men boys and wakes up before dawn to bake donuts, but I'm very intuitive.
I don't doubt that.
So what's going on with you two?
Kelsey opened her eyes wide.
There's nothing going on between us. We are breaking into county buildings and looking at autopsy reports, not dating.
Kelsey pointed at Ray. And that's a secret, by the way, about breaking in, not to be repeated to anyone.
But do you like him?
Do I what?
I knew it!
Kelsey shook her head. Knew what?
Never answer a yes or no question with a question. It's a dead giveaway.
There was a pause before Kelsey said, He called me and offered his help on something I was stuck on. Last night we went down to Eastgate and snuck into the Buchanan County Government Center to find Becca's autopsy report.
Kelsey paused a minute.
I was moved that he was so willing to help me. That's it.
Have you thought about him this morning?
Kelsey shrugged.
Yeah.
Ray opened her arms wide.
And there it is. You're having guy issues. Why else would you be thinking about him? And that's not a bad thing. It's fun.
Kelsey squinted her eyes at the young girl's ability to drag her along to a point where she had no choice but to agree.
But dish again, Ray said.
You find anything with the autopsy?
Lots.
Like what? Kelsey looked up at the falling water, then back to Ray.
We're friends?
Of course. You'd keep a secret if I asked you, right?
To my grave.
Then I'm asking.
Ray nodded.
Kelsey stirred the water with her feet, then looked back to Ray.
Becca was pregnant when she died. Get out.
Kelsey nodded. Loaded up with HCG, a hormone produced during pregnancy. And when I talked to Millie Mays the other day, she told me Becca confessed to Livy that she ran off and married some guy she was dating. So we've got a marriage no one knew about, a secret pregnancy, and a dead girl.
Ray slowly raised her chin. And you think the guy she married killed her?
He's leading the race of suspects, yes.
Who is he?
No clue. So that puts me at a big fork in the road. I need to talk to people who knew Becca. Since her family is not about to tell me anything, and I can't get to her sequestered Facebook postings or emails, I either have to go to DC and start asking around, find some of her friends who are willing to talk,
or
I find Becca's journal. Kelsey paused a moment. You make any progress on that, by chance?
Maybe, Ray said. I talked to Millie. She's old and sounds like she's losing it sometimes, but she knows more than she's letting on about the night Becca was killed. I told Millie the gossip group is in a frenzy about Becca keeping a journal. That's all they talk about. I asked Millie if she knew anything about it, if Livy said anything about a journal.
And?
She just shrugged, which means she knows all about it. I told her the police never found a journal at the Stilt house, and you know what she said?
Kelsey raised her eyebrows.
How could they have?
That's what she said to me.
How could they have? Said it right to my face and then got up and made sweet tea.
Kelsey shifted on the rock. What's that mean?
Not sure, but it sounds like the old lady knows where that journal is.
Yeah? How do we get our hands on it?
Ray smiled. I'm working on it.
They both pulled their feet from the water and slipped their socks on.
Want a coffee? Ray asked. I'm sweaty and gross, Kelsey said.
Iced coffee then.
Done. They jogged back through the canopied forest and cooled down as they walked along Maple Street to the coffee house. Inside, Kelsey took a spot at the bar while Ray prepared the drinks. Next to Kelsey, the gossip group was at it. The redhead was arguing with the heavyset lady when Kelsey sat down, but their conversation was interrupted by the 40-year-old guy, who held up a finger to quiet the group. Then he pointed at Kelsey.
Aren't you Kelsey Castle?
The whole group, six of them this morning, turned and stared with quizzical looks and wide eyes, as though a movie star had just graced their presence. Before Kelsey could answer, the guy said,
You're here because of Becca, right?
He looked around at his cohorts.
I told you she was here. This is crazy. Our little town has the attention of Advance Magazine?
All right, Ray said, setting the iced coffee in front of Kelsey and standing behind the mahogany bar. Don't accost my other customers.
Ray, the 40-year-old said, you knew Kelsey Castle was in town and didn't tell us?
For a group of detectives like yourselves, you're not too observant. Kelsey's been here for a week and has come in here almost every morning.
Do you know who did it?
The heavyset woman asked, like a child begging for dessert. Kelsey smiled. I know probably as much as you all do.
Why won't the police give any details?
The redhead asked with her eyes closed.
Not sure about that, since they won't tell me anything either. When will your article run?
The 40-year-old asked.
Not sure on that either. I don't have anything to write about yet. But you're not buying the random stranger argument?
He asked. Kelsey shrugged. About as much as you are. The 40-year-old smiled and looked at his crowd, nodding.
I told you it was too random.
He looked back at Kelsey.
So it was, you think it was someone Becca knew, right? Maybe someone she was close to?
Kelsey smiled again. I don't know what I think yet. I haven't gotten very far.
Here's what we think, he said,
then looked at the heavyset woman at the end of the bar.
At least what most of us think. Becca got mixed up with someone, like a lawyer at her father's firm or some other quasi-high-profile attorney, maybe to help her later in her career, maybe just because they fell in love. The affair turned into something, illicit, secretive, scandalous, whatever. Eventually, either she wanted out or he wanted out. The other didn't.
The 40-year-old slapped his hands together.
Boom! There's your motive.
Kelsey puckered her lower lip. Interesting theory. You guys have been busy working on this, huh?
Every morning, Red said. They never stop.
Come on, the 40-year-old said. Becca was young, gorgeous, and smart. This has to be a crime of passion, no?
Maybe, Kelsey said. Go get me some suspects to interview, or something important to run with, and I'll put you in my article.
Really?
The heavyset woman said, her eyes wide and urgent.
Did you tell her about the journal?
The 40-year-old asked Ray. He groomed his goatee with his hand, smiling like he held an unknown secret.
I haven't told Kelsey any of your theories. She's pretty good at what she does without the gossip group's input.
It's not a theory, he said to Kelsey. I've heard it from more than one person. Becca kept a journal, and I bet the cops have it right now. That's probably why they're being so quiet about the case, just ticking off each person in the journal until they hit pay dirt. But they don't want anyone knowing their play. Don't want to spook any of the suspects.
Okay, Ray said. Keep working on that one. I think you're almost there. We're drinking our coffee by the fire. Nice to meet you all, Kelsey said.
If you need any statements or anything,
the heavyset woman said, just ask. You can quote any of us.
Will do,
Kelsey said, before retreating with Ray to the thick stuffed leather chairs by the fire.
Sorry about that, Ray said. I've heard it every morning for the last couple of weeks.
The theories get more and more bizarre, and completely change based on what's printed in the paper each morning.
I love it, Kelsey said. A group of conspiracy theorists.
Ray smiled. That's summit-like for you. Before they had Becca to gossip about, it was something about the water being contaminated and every government official knowing about it, but not wanting to spend money to fix it. Cancer and cover-ups and lawsuits, always something.
Morning gossip in coffee houses around the world, right?
Kelsey took a sip. She lowered her voice. So, dish yourself. They're actually onto something with a journal. I'm shocked. They've discovered something useful.
And if a bunch of gossips are close, the cops are closer. We need to find Becca's journal before anyone else does.
Ray smiled. I told you. I'm working on it.
Chapter 21. Becca Eckersley, George Washington University, May 13, 2011, 9 months before her death. The campus began to fill on Thursday. By Friday afternoon, traffic was tight as parents converged on campus and filled the walkways of George Washington University to see their sons and daughters graduate. There were rumors of Secret Service agents on campus, as the vice president was due to deliver Saturday's commencement speech. It was an exciting time for the graduating students, who had mostly forgotten about their classmate who hanged himself the month before. To most, he was just a statistic. But to Becca and Jack, it was a much more tangible commodity. It was something they were both part of, an event they each felt they played a distinct role in producing. And because they were so close to it, ignoring it or letting it drift into the past was an impossible task. Brad Reynolds hanged himself on April 7th, 5 weeks before the ceremonial commencement day at GWU, and no one's life had been the same since. He sent Jack the text message just before he kicked the chair out from underneath himself, and he hung for 63 seconds before the kitchen door opened and Becca witnessed her friend dangling from the kitchen rafters. The weeks leading to graduation were a quiet and isolated time for Becca and Jack, who spent most of their time together. They had trouble staying at Jack's apartment. Every time they opened the door, they saw Brad's feet twirling and twitching over the kitchen floor. Sleeping there was simply not possible. In the middle of April, Jack received a phone call from the admissions office at Harvard Law. A formal letter followed 4 days later, and Jack placed it ceremoniously next to his acceptance letter from months earlier. Becca placed her head on his shoulder and dabbed tears from her eyes as she hugged him. He wouldn't show any emotion. That was the way he handled things, Becca knew. And though Jack acted numb to the news and detached from the reality that he would not be attending Harvard Law or any other law program that fall, Becca knew eventually it would hit him.
Well, Jack said to Becca, some kid on the waiting list just got the best news of his life.
Becca listened to Jack's philosophy about how life worked. One person's misfortune was another's dream come true, whether it was getting into law school or getting the girl of your dreams. She listened, but didn't buy his bravado. She knew, despite all the talk about not wanting to practice law, he was hurt badly by the news, which was why she agreed without hesitation to go with him. Becca finished packing Friday night. The graduation ceremony would be the next morning. Her parents had been up the weekend before to haul her possessions back to Greensboro for the summer. It was just before 10 p.m. when she entered Jack's apartment.
Sure you want to skip it? Jack asked.
Becca nodded. I don't need the whispers and stares when they call our names.
I don't think anyone will whisper and stare, but I don't want to find out anyway. Are your parents okay with it?
Becca nodded. They weren't thrilled, but they came last week to get my stuff, so they're going along with it. They know this whole thing has been tough, and we're just trying to figure out how to handle it.
Didn't you think this year would be different?
That's a rhetorical question, right?
I guess, Jack said.
He was sitting on the bed of his empty room.
When I trace it back, things were going really well until we stole that damn test, and nothing's really been the same since. I mean, follow Brad's life since we stole that test.
Jack, we didn't do any of that to Brad, okay? Brad did it to himself. It sounds cold and terrible, and I miss him like I'd miss my brother. but you and I are not responsible for what happened to him. To protect us all, you took the blame for something he did, so that should absolve you of your guilt. Harvard was taken away from you, which I think is a lot worse than not getting in. And I know it was your thing, so I never got involved, but I think it was pretty shitty that Brad let you take the blame for the test. Jack pulled his cell phone from his pocket and paged through his texts.
He sent this to me right before.
Jack handed her his phone.
You took her from me, Jack. But I guess she was never really mine.
Becca stared for a minute at the phone, her lips silently reading and rereading the message.
God, Jack, she sat on his bed. Why didn't you tell me about this?
What's to tell? You knew he was pissed we were sneaking around behind his back. This only adds a small element that he thinks I somehow stole you from him.
It's almost creepy. I'm starting to think of Brad in a different way. She shook her head. I don't know. I just want to find a way to move on.
I hear you, Jack said.
He stood from the bed and grabbed his duffel bag.
Ready?
Let's go, she said. Jack dragged the two duffel bags that represented everything he owned in the world down the stairs and crammed them into the trunk. He threw Becca's bag into the back seat and made one last pass through the apartment, taking the TV in his arms and leaving everything else that didn't stand a chance at fitting into his Volvo. Last month, Brad's parents had been through the apartment to collect their son's belongings, leaving nothing but memories and an empty bedroom. Jack and Becca paused before backing out the doorway, TV cradled in his arms, and tears welled in Becca's eyes. They each looked up at the I-beam that ran the length of the kitchen. The last 5 weeks brought many scenarios into their minds of how things could have gone differently. Jack could have skipped his flight the day Brad confessed his love for Becca, stayed with his friend when Brad needed him most. Becca could have told Brad everything during one of their late-night talks and diffused the bomb ticking in his mind. They could have told the truth from the beginning, when Gail and Brad returned for senior year. Jack could have taken that key from Brad and told him how stupid it was to steal a test, and together, they could have weighed more seriously the consequences of getting caught. Maybe those things would have prevented the year from unfolding the way it had. Maybe nothing would have changed. Becca and Jack finally walked down the steps, leaving the apartment door wide open. Jack tossed the television into the back seat, and they each climbed in and waited for the old Volvo to turn over. The engine finally caught, and they pulled slowly from the parking lot. 2 hours later, Washington, D.C. was an absent thing in the rearview mirror, and only dark highway was in front of them, like their lives, illuminated by the Volvo's headlights for only a short stretch, black and unknowing beyond the immediate. They drove without fatigue through the night, with very little conversation, until the sun filled the mirrors the next morning and stretched the Volvo into a long shadow that glided over the highway in front of them. About the time their names were being called back at graduation, they crossed the Mississippi River. 2 days after they left Washington, D.C., Becca and Jack ended up in Wyoming. They purchased a tent and a campsite at the Yellowstone Conservatory and found their lot in the Bay Bridge campground, where they pitched their tent and slept for 12 straight hours. They spent 2 days wandering small hiking trails under the high blue sky. That first night at their campsite, Becca and Jack sat and stared into the orange flames of the fire, thinking of Brad and the way everything ended. They talked until the sun set and darkness fell over the valley. They climbed into their tent and snuggled next to each other in the sleeping bag. Besides the things they couldn't control and were powerless to change, Becca and Jack decided the worst they had done was fall in love and keep it to themselves. They could live with that. Becca would start her first year at George Washington Law in the fall, and she would meet new people and make new friends. Law school was off the table for Jack, and his future less certain. Word spread of the stolen exam and his rejection from Harvard Law, which did not bode well for his prospects of finding a job in D.C. Though he had not dwelled on it much, being preoccupied with guilt and remorse. Now, under the starry night in Yellowstone National Park, Jack contemplated how his life had changed from a few short weeks ago. And when he allowed himself to consider his future, it sunk in that taking the blame for the stolen test may have affected his life more greatly than he originally considered. The night grew cold, and Becca and Jack pulled the sleeping bag over their heads and fell asleep. Chapter 22. Kelsey Castle, Summit Lake, March 13, 2012, Day 9. "You told me to figure out why her secret was a secret, so I did," Kelsey said, as she sat with Commander Ferguson in the small breakfast place on the lake. "I know why Becca got married." They sat at the bar, sipping bitter coffee, while the commander picked at a stale donut.
"I'm listening."
"She was pregnant." The commander stopped his picking, looked around the diner to make sure no one was paying attention to them.
"Where did you come up with this theory?"
"It's not a theory," Kelsey said in a hushed voice. "According to Michelle Maddox, the county medical examiner who did the autopsy, it's a fact. Becca's blood work was positive for HCG, the hormone produced during pregnancy." Kelsey pulled a sheet of paper from her purse and laid it on the bar in front of Commander Ferguson. It was a printed page from the autopsy report describing the internal exam and Dr. Maddox's discovery of a female fetus presumed to be in the fifth gestational month.
"Son of a bitch,"
Commander Ferguson said, lifting the page from the bar and squinting at the words. He looked at Kelsey with a droopy eyelids and congested face of a man who drank and smoked too much.
"Should I bother asking how you got hold of an autopsy report I haven't seen yet?"
Kelsey sipped her coffee. "You should not." The commander shook his head slightly and offered a hint of a smile. After a moment, his face relaxed in a stoic stare as he considered this new information.
"So she got knocked up, then ran off and married the guy real quick?"
"It's plausible. Might explain why the family is trying to cover things up. A prominent father who is quasi-famous with his law firm and getting ready for a run at the bench doesn't want it known that his unmarried, pregnant daughter was raped?"
"I thought we were saying she was married."
"Secretly married. Maybe worse for a prominent attorney that his daughter ran off and eloped. But I need some help. These are all important parts of the puzzle, but alone they don't get me any closer to figuring out who broke into the Eckersley's house that night."
"Well," the commander said, twisting his coffee cup on the bar. "First, you have to remember, no one broke into that house. There was no sign of forced entry, which means a recent GWU graduate and current law student was either too ignorant to know not to open the door for a strange man while alone at her family's vacation home, or she knew the person and allowed him to freely enter the house."
"Okay," Kelsey said. "So Becca disengages the alarm and opens the door. For whom? She was married and pregnant, but who the hell killed her?"
"Couple angles there off the top of my head."
Commander Ferguson took a sip of coffee, then looked around again. The diner was mostly empty.
"Maybe your source was wrong about the marriage. Or maybe the Eckersley girl was wrong about the guy's intentions. Maybe she wanted to get married, and in her mind thought whoever got her pregnant wanted the same thing. She goes around telling people this, or at least tells your source. The only problem? The guy doesn't want to marry her. Doesn't want a kid either. And there's one way to fix that problem."
Kelsey lifted her chin. She thought of a similar scenario, although not phrased quite so bluntly. It was a good theory, but one with missing characters. And they were going about this backward. You typically find a suspect and then look for motive, not the other way around. Commander Ferguson let out one of his horsey laughs as he watched her wrestle with possibilities.
"No one said this stuff was easy to figure out. But as you move along on this case, I want you to remember something."
"What's that?"
"In my experience, you can fit the person who does something this terrible to a beautiful young woman into two categories. The first is someone who hated the victim."
"I've considered that," Kelsey said. "And so far, I've been unable to come up with anyone who might have hated Becca Eckersley,
The girl had no enemies.
So that brings us to the only other category of person who might do this, which is someone who loved her.
Later that night, after her visit with Commander Ferguson, Kelsey sat in her suite at the Winchester and tapped her computer. She was at the small dining table, which was covered with research material on the Eckersley case. A pegboard was propped on a chair and decorated with photos of the Eckersley's house and Kelsey's handwritten flowcharts of Becca's movements the day she died, from the campus of GWU in the morning, through the mountains to Summit Lake, to Millie's coffee house, and finally to the Eckersley's stilt house. Times were written at each location to keep things straight in her mind. She went back through the information she received from Commander Ferguson. Within an hour, the other chairs were covered with stacks of paper she organized in a system coherent only to herself. She came across travel information for Becca, an outline of her movements in the months leading up to her death. Becca started law school in August, 6 months before she was killed, and the police had tracked her to only 3 trips outside of D.C. in those months. The first was in November, when she ventured to Greensboro, presumably going home for Thanksgiving. The next were airplane records to Green Bay, Wisconsin over Christmas. The last trip out of D.C. was her drive to Summit Lake, the day she was killed. Kelsey started in Greensboro, cross-referencing credit card receipts and ATM records with the Eckersley's home address. Definitely a trip home for Thanksgiving. Next, she moved to the Green Bay trip. What was in Green Bay that would make Becca go there over Christmas break? A guy, Kelsey concluded. What else would take a 22-year-old student away from her family over Christmas? Kelsey spent another hour poring through Becca's phone records, looking for any calls made to Wisconsin area codes. None. Although over a 3-day period that covered Christmas, Kelsey found one call per day to the Eckersley's home number in Greensboro that routed through a cell tower in Green Bay. She was close, but she needed a name or phone number or address or something to track. On her computer, she pulled up the 1L class of GW Law, nearly 100 names. She deleted the females and settled on 52 male students who attended law school with Becca Eckersley. Painstaking research told her only 3 were from Wisconsin, and none from Green Bay. She hunkered down for 3 more hours and looked into the other male students in the L2 and L3 classes. Not one was from Green Bay. She even looked briefly at profiles of the attorneys in William Eckersley's law firm, running briefly with a gossip group's theory that Becca might have been involved with one of her father's colleagues. It was a short run, though, since none was from Wisconsin. She put her notes from GW Law to the side and looked further back in Commander Ferguson's records. During the summer after Becca graduated college, she was noted to have been on a private jet belonging to Milt Ward, a Maryland senator. Kelsey licked her finger and paged through some notes. Milt Ward was all over the news. Why was a senator from Maryland flying you around on his private jet? Feeling she was onto something, she grabbed another stack of papers and started to dig. But a knock on the door interrupted her research. She looked at the clock. 11:18 p.m. Through the peephole, she saw a man dressed in a suit, with his tie loosened and crooked.
"Miss Castle?" the man said, knocking again. "My name is Detective Madison. I saw your light on, so I figured you were up."
Kelsey pulled the door open as far as the chain would allow. "Yes?"
"Good," the detective said. "You're still awake. Can we talk?"
"About what?"
"Becca Eckersley."
"Can I see some ID?"
"Of course."
The detective removed his badge from his hip and handed it through the slot between the door and frame. He also offered his driver's license.
"I'd be happy to talk down in the lobby if you're more comfortable there."
Kelsey scrutinized the badge and knew it was legit. She'd talked to Commander Ferguson about this guy. Madison was one of the state detectives who had taken the case from the Summit Lake Police Force. "What's so important that you're knocking at my door at 11 at night?"
"There's been an important development."
Kelsey closed the door and unlatched the chain. "Here," she said when she opened the door, handing the badge and ID back to the detective. "Something about Becca?"
"Can I come in?"
"Sure," Kelsey said. "The place is a mess." Detective Madison walked into the suite and looked around at the cluttered research covering the table and chairs.
"You have been busy."
"I'm here on assignment."
"So I've heard."
He walked over to the table and flipped a finger through some pages. "Please don't touch my property, detective," Kelsey said, "unless you have a warrant."
"I don't," the detective said, turning and facing Kelsey. "What are you trying to accomplish here?"
"I'm writing an article about Becca Eckersley." He glanced back at the table and chairs covered in papers and outlines.
"A magazine article or a book?"
Kelsey's face stayed stoic. "An article?"
"Why so much digging for a simple article?"
"Becca's is a complicated story."
"That's for sure."
"So what's this development that has you out so late?" The detective smiled.
"I'd appreciate it if you'd stop poking around places you're not meant to poke around."
"I'm a journalist writing a story, Detective Madison. Poking around is what I do. And since you guys are so secretive about the details of this case, I've had to put things together by piecemeal research."
"Piece things together however you'd like. But if you break the law, you'll pay the price."
"Asking questions in Summit Lake is hardly breaking the law."
"Agreed. But breaking into a government building is."
Kelsey didn't hesitate. "Who broke into any buildings?" Detective Madison smiled again.
"I'm working on that, trust me. But surveillance footage shows two individuals using a stolen access key to enter the Buchanan County Government Center the other night. The same card was then used to enter a private office and access classified documents."
Now Kelsey smiled. "Classified? Is Buchanan County, way up here in the mountains, responsible for some secret nuclear program?"
"That's cute. Where were you two nights ago?"
"Detective, please do not come to my hotel suite and try to intimidate me."
"I'm simply asking a question."
"Which carries the implication that I somehow broke into this building you're talking about."
"Did you?"
"If you'd like to interrogate me, then arrest me and do it at the police station." Detective Madison puckered his lower lip in contemplation.
"When are you going back to Miami?"
"When I finish my article."
"Oh."
The detective laughed, shaking his head.
"I don't think you'll make it that long. Once I know for sure it's you on that surveillance footage, I'm going to arrest you, if you're still in Summit Lake. And I'm going to arrest whomever you were with. Do you understand?"
"Not really, because I don't know what the hell you're talking about." The detective put a thumb over his shoulder.
"And I noticed some of your research material is stamped with a Summit Lake Police Department seal. You steal that too?"
Kelsey didn't answer.
"No," the detective said. "I bet you didn't have to. Stan Ferguson probably gave it to you, because he's being a pain in the ass since he was asked to step aside. Leaking information to the media about an active investigation is a big no-no."
The detective shook his head as he walked to the door.
"Have a good night, Miss Castle."
He closed the door behind him, and Kelsey ran to the peephole to watch him walk down the hallway and enter the elevator. She grabbed her cell phone and called Penn Courtney. She got his voicemail and left a curt message to call back. She also texted him and left the same message on his home phone. She grabbed her jacket on the way out of her hotel room. She made fast work of the 5 blocks to the coffee house, which she knew was long closed. She looked up to the second story. The windows were dark. Around back, Kelsey climbed the stairs and knocked softly on the door. When there was no answer, she knocked harder, and the kitchen light finally blinked on. The curtains moved to the side, and then the door opened. "What's wrong?" Ray asked. "I need your help." "Come in," Ray said. Dressed in flannel pajama pants and a tank top, Ray shuffled through the kitchen with slippers covering her feet. "What's going on?" "The lead detective in the Eckersley case just paid me a visit." With sleepy eyes, Ray squinted at the wall clock. "What time is it?"
"Almost midnight."
"Why were the police at your hotel room at midnight?"
"Because I think I'm in trouble. The guy's name is Madison, and he wanted to know why I was poking around so much."
"So tell him you're writing a story. No crime there."
"Agreed. Except I illegally entered the county building the other night with Peter and looked at an autopsy report that was not made public."
"I thought that was a secret."
"Yeah, well, not quite," Kelsey said. "I'm on a surveillance camera in front of the building."
"Oh, boy."
"Yeah."
"The best journalists make the worst criminals,"
Isn't that how the saying goes?
Kelsey shook her head.
Okay, so don't freak out just yet. What's the guy want?
Me to leave Summit Lake.
How close are you on Becca's article?
Really close.
There was a long pause where Kelsey shrugged.
At least coming up with some ideas that don't match anything the police are looking at. I just need some time to work things out. Commander Ferguson says the state guys are stuck on the theory of a drifter strolling through town that night and randomly entering the Eckersleys' house.
You obviously disagree.
Completely. Becca was killed by someone she knew.
Who?
I don't know. I'm right on the edge here, but I don't have the resources I need. Usually, I'd talk to the family to get a picture of her life, get some personal insight into this girl, find out who her friends were, who she dated, but there's no chance of talking to the family.
How about her friends?
I don't know who her friends were. I don't have access to any of her emails, and her Facebook account is offline, subpoenaed by the DA and completely out of my reach. I could head to DC and start poking around GWU until someone tells me something useful, but I get the feeling from Detective Madison's visit that going to DC to poke around won't be an option for me.
So, what's your plan?
Kelsey took a deep breath.
You and I go to Millie's and get that journal.
Ray laughed. Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
That's what you think, though, right? Millie has that journal?
The thoughts crossed my mind, but I don't know this for certain.
So let's find out. I need to know about Becca's life. Then I can piece things together and come up with a theory of who killed her. I can't talk to her family and don't have the time to track down her friends. Right now, Becca's journal is my only hope. Otherwise, I lose the story.
Kelsey stared at Ray, moved a little closer to her. I need your help on this.
Ray shook her head and looked at the ceiling as she thought, okay, but if Millie somehow has the journal and has kept it this long from the police, she's certainly not about to hand it over to us.
Not a chance. So what's the plan?
Ray smiled. I don't have a plan. This was your idea.
Stop it. You know we're on the same page.
Ray slowly nodded. We are.
So, Kelsey said, how do we get our hands on that journal?
We get creative.